The number one resolution for people last year was to save more money, but nearly half gave up by February. Don't let that be you. Download Rocket Money to reach your financial goals this year. Track your spending, cut waste, and automate savings in one simple app. Rocket Money shows you all your expenses and categorizes them, so you know exactly where your money's going and where you're overspending. From there, the app cuts waste by canceling your unused subscriptions and lowering your bills. No customer service needed. With that money freed up, the app will automatically set some cash aside for your goals. Whether it's an emergency fund, paying off debt, or saving for vacation, Rocket Money's got you covered. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. And on average, users can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Make saving money a priority this year. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
My mother has a cat named Thimble who stalked me when I was a child. I was 10 or so at the time, and I had just witnessed my first death in the family. I say Thimble stalked me because it was obvious she was following me around, but she chose not to come too close. Always a little distance away, on the couch or in the middle of the carpet, watching me. She wouldn't come over to lie at my feet or jump onto my lap. She wouldn't respond to anyone calling her. She just sat there, placidly, looking at me. Every now and then, those gold-flecked green eyes would dart over my shoulder and then to me, back and forth, like someone was waving a laser pointer around my head that only she could see. But she would make no further movements. She would watch me in silence until she grew heavy-lidded with drowsiness and settled down on her paws to snooze, still in the middle of the carpet. It became a kind of family tradition, an expectation that if anyone were looking for her, they would find her next to me. I can still find old photographs, candid shots of myself as a young boy in Sunday clothes, seated at the table in the foreground, glancing to the side, where Thimble sat on the floor a little way into the distance, like she hadn't been invited and wanted us to know she was displeased about it. Her dispassionate little face would be turned my way, as if she were tasked to supervise me and found it an especially dull job, but one she took seriously. Years later, when she was old and dying, I visited her little den at the bottom of a bookcase where my mother had covered the opening with an embroidered, tasseled cloth. I would pull back the cloth and peer into the darkness as though spying into a shrine or a sacred little gravesite for the still living. I would find the gentle heaving mound of fur, lying prone and stiff, facing away from the entrance, and gaze at her white and ginger coats half glowing in the dim space. Just as I determined she was still breathing, a hand would yank me back roughly by the collar, usually my mother or Nan or my eldest brother scolding me about disturbing her, reminding me about how cats needed to be alone when they were nearing their end. The cloth would be respectfully replaced, and I would be kicked out into the sunshine. Dying alone, it always seemed such an unbearably sad way for someone to go, I thought. So I kept checking. I kept getting in trouble for it. "She'll never die peacefully at this rate," my mother would say. She meant to emphasize the peacefulness or the lack of it, but I focused on the death. I thought if I visited Thimble enough, I could disturb her, distract her out of dying. She had been in the den 3 days. She should have died much earlier, I heard, so it must have been working. On the afternoon of the 4th day, certain that there was nobody close by, I lifted the shroud and glanced in, pretending to check on her water dish. Thimble had moved for the first time, lying on her other side so that her face was towards me, her paws stretched slightly out and seemingly already stiff with death. But as I watched her closed-up face, her eyes slowly opened, the secondary eyeball a moment delayed so that, for a second or so, her eyes were entirely and then partially white and shielded. She looked otherworldly, possessed, but now her eyes were open, her faded green pupils contracting to slits from the light of the hall. She stared sleepily at me without expression or pain, or even recognition. And then, just like all the times in the past I'd grown accustomed to. Her gaze flickered over my shoulder, as though someone were there trying to get her attention. But of course, there was nobody there. There never was anybody there, every time I'd ever looked behind me in my childhood. Just as surely as I had grown used to this glance, I had grown secure in the knowledge that there was nothing, that there would never be anything, and that this was just something odd that all cats did. This time, however, there was a small difference in how she behaved. A slight difference, but one I remember clearly and with apprehension, knowing what I know now. She flicked her tail and narrowed her eyes, as though she were annoyed. Her ear twitched, her tail flickered once, twice, and then fell still. She did not glance back at me. Her eyes were now glazed and unseeing over my shoulder. The faint light of defiance in the graceful lines of her face dimmed out, and her breathing returned to its steady, slow pace until she ceased to move again. I scrambled up to run and find someone and announce Thimble's death. I don't remember feeling anything in particular other than a mild pang and, at the end, a vague curiosity. I never got to understand her. Cats die with their secrets. Hers was the second death I ever witnessed, and she would be among the first of many. The first was my strange Grandma Elizabeth from Dad's side of the family. You could say she started everything. I was 9, going on 10. Thimble had just been brought into the house as a kitten. Her stalking would begin a few months later. I would never be the same after Grandma came to live with us for the short time we had known her, but I didn't know it at the time. Thimble would be the first to notice what had changed. For reasons withheld from us, my parents had kept Grandma Elizabeth away from the family when we were growing up, and as far as I know, Grandma never made an attempt to connect with her estranged son and the grandchildren she had never met. There was some talk about her being difficult, even before she had been widowed, and my parents didn't want us growing up with that sort of damage. So we never got to know her, she never got to know us. Then, towards the end of her life, she made a sudden, mysterious introduction into our home. She was dying, our father explains to us. And she was alone. Nobody should ever die alone. So she was given the guest room upstairs, and so far gone was she that I didn't think we'd really ever met in any real sense of the word. We might have been vague presences fitting about her room, sent up to check on her for all she was aware. All we knew of her in life before her illness were what little our parents spoke of her, and what survived in photo albums. Just one face among other strangers, dead before we were born. Just like Thimble, I was the last to see her alive. Knowing what I know now, I turned the scene over in my mind every so often, wondering what I could have done to change how things would turn out. I still wonder whether any of it had been my fault, or if I had just been at the wrong place at the wrong time. I remember the chill of the air, the dim light behind the curtain in the guest room where Grandma Elizabeth had died. In the weeks leading up to her death, she had gone completely unresponsive. The family had taken to visiting her in turns. It had been a few weeks of no change, no improvement. She was in a coma, a vegetable. It had been my turn to be sent upstairs to check on whether she, to put it bluntly, had left yet. Not yet, I realized, watching the glass fog up on the tiny pocket mirror I held up by her nose, the way I was taught to do. We couldn't even tell she was breathing under those blankets. But just as I was about to head off and report the lack of change to my parents, Grandma made a sound, the kind of sound I imagined she might have made when she was so angry she lost her words, but not her voice. The sound was dry, scratchy, a bit warped and lower down in her throat than I expected it to be, but the anger, I felt, was there. I had frozen in place and turned back around. Her eyes were wide open, glassy, staring at the ceiling. I had recently learned the term death rattle, which I had read somewhere in a book, and wondered if this was it. Gingerly, I crept over with the mirror to see if I could catch her last breath. But just as I reached out, her hand shot out and found my wrist. The only sudden movement, in fact, the only real movement she had made for days. She held on, her frailty leaving her for a moment, so that her hand on mine was like the talons of a bird on prey. I dropped the mirror in shock and pain, and it bounced once on the duvet and stayed there, blinking back the dim light at me. I couldn't make a sound. Her eyes were still wide and glassy, points of pale green light reflected in her irises like the mirror lying on the duvet. And now they were looking at me, or at least in my direction. I couldn't tell if she could ever register my presence, much less recognize me. Neither her hand nor her eyes let me go. The sound came again from her throat, whispery now, like she was trying to tell me something without being able to move her lips, like she was trapped in her own failing body, trying to reach out to me for help. The idea of it frightened me more than the fact that she was dying, or the fact that she was already dead, that she had died looking into my eyes, her hand on mine. Helplessly, struck mute, I stared back until the noise died away. The twin points of light glimmered out of her eyes were as flat to me as those of a fish. Her hands did not loosen from my wrist. Already they were tightening in rigor mortis. She had escaped her body with her last breath. But now I was the one trapped. I remember distinctly that I wished I had left the door open. Eventually, my family found me, standing there by the bed, stock still and unable to speak for several moments. I had moved my hand to rest on top of Grandma Elizabeth's, as thought to console her, but the lifelessness of her skin had stopped me cold, and I had made no effort to pry myself free. They figured I was in shock. I had apparently been there for all of 10 minutes, but that number meant nothing to me. I don't remember feeling afraid, but I felt that something had changed, and I wasn't sure I liked it. For most of my childhood, I had locked that scene out of my memory, able to recall it now with little signs of trauma as just an odd fact of my personal history. I had never drawn a connection between Grandma Elizabeth and Thimble. Even at that age, I had witnessed the crossing over more times than anyone in my family, but I only realized this the moment I burst into the living room to find my family and tell them the cat had finally died. One of my elder brothers had made a snide comment. Perhaps miffed he hadn't caught me bothering Thimble when it had been his job to watch me. He said, "I see the Angel of Death has another report for us." It was such a toss-away comment, it was easy to dismiss it at the time and simply focus on the task at hand of finding a shoebox to bury Thimble in. But thinking back on it, I realize he was right. Grandma had only been able to die when I was in the room, and the same thing happened with Thimble. I didn't know why that was until I witnessed the next death. The following summer, after Thimble died, my mother gave birth to our youngest brother, making us a family of 5 boys. He almost didn't make it, a cord around the neck, but finally came through with apparently no further problems. That close brush with death and the fact that he was born sickly, as most 5th children are, made him the darling of the family. I, for one, showed no special affection for the newest sibling, who was named Todd, yet he clung to me the most outside of our mother. He hadn't even taken much to Nan, whom we all loved in that distant, hesitant way of young boys. Naturally, my mother encouraged this bond between us brothers and often left young Todd in my care. At 13 months, Todd hadn't yet learned to speak. One weekend morning, I almost wished he could. I had been tasked to help Nan feed him while he sat imprisoned in his high chair at the kitchen table. All he could do to protest was wave his arms about and gurgle whatever I was successful in getting a half-spoon of gloop past his defense. Nan sighed and got up from the table to go find a clean washcloth. Once she had gone, I relaxed in my efforts, and then I noticed that Todd had gone silent, too. I glanced at him, relieved, but his expression gave me pause. He was looking intently at me, as though confused by what he was seeing. It was almost comical, seeing a worry crease on a baby's forehead, like seeing an infant dressed up in a businessman's suit and tie. He was gazing into my face, for once not responding to my smile. And then, as if perfectly trained by the cat, Thimble, who had died before he was born, he glanced over my shoulder. I turned and saw the creeping white roses of our wallpaper dimmed by my shadow. Nothing else. I looked back around. Todd continued to watch, flicking his eyes to something just a little behind my head. Something completely insensible to me. He would not, of course, answer any of my questions as to what he was seeing. Nan came into the kitchen then, happy at how I had gotten Todd to behave. I was rather unnerved and said nothing. As soon as I picked up the spoon, Todd went reassuringly berserk again. That would be the first time of many that I would catch him staring at me and over my shoulder, and I had to learn all over again not to look, to get used to the fact that I would not find anything. But I was no longer sure that there was nothing. I still maintained that Thimble had been more intelligent than a toddler, but somehow, I had to take the knowing glance of a human being a little more seriously than that of a cat, whose ways are always easily misconstrued by people. For years, I had never sensed anything off about Todd aside from that glance, and neither did anybody else. He never glanced like that over anyone else's shoulder, just as Thimble hadn't, only at me. And just as my family had marveled at Thimble following me around, they marveled at how Todd latched on to me. Photos of my early adolescent years now featured a toddler rather than a cat, standing or sitting some distance away, always at a distance, content to just watch me, sometimes for hours on end. Mother made a joking comment once about how I must have had a very engaging aura, but we both know she was just being a tease. I couldn't in good faith say I was anything above ordinary, and I know for a fact I did not have this curious magnetic effect on other cats or other children I knew at the time. Just Thimble, and just Todd. I had noticed in Thimble as well that her attraction to me was hardly about me. She was primarily our mother's cat, rescued as a near-death kitten in a ditch outside of mother's workplace. And as she grew up and settled in at home, she didn't give a rat's ass about me or my brothers, but whatever it was that held her attention, it was happening just over my shoulder. I sensed this same indifferent fascination with Todd. He would grow quieter than any of us boys, uncommonly quiet, even more so when he talked to me. He didn't shriek with delight or call out to me in the cheerful way of children calling for attention. He merely looked and went quiet and stayed by my side, a little distance away, on the floor or in his walker, or later, when he could stand on his own, stopped picture still in the doorway or the middle of the carpet, tracking me with his eyes. All that was familiar to me too, thanks to Thimble, but with one notable difference I could look forward to. Todd would grow up at some point, and he would be able to talk. And unlike Thimble, he would be able to tell me what or who, angel or devil, had lingered over my shoulder for as long as he had known me. Todd never did learn to speak the usual way. He had developed an infection that almost killed him at 2 years old, but though he survived, he had lost the use of his vocal cords. He learned to sign instead, and he was 7 when I was showing him photos of Thimble. Many of them photos featuring me as a younger boy, a little older than he was now. We sat together at the low coffee table in the living room, with family photo albums spread out before us. I was trying to keep him occupied until Nan returned from an errand to dismiss me from service, but I didn't mind. I had grown used to Todd's company, and even come to accept it. He was an easy kid, intelligent, thoughtful. "It's strange to see you alone here," he sighed, pointing to a photo of me when I was much younger. I couldn't place the age of the photo, but it was definitely from before Grandma Elizabeth came to live with us, even before Thimble. There were 4 boys instead of 5, me being the youngest at the time. But I wasn't alone. It was a family photo. All the brothers, side by side. Alone? What do you mean? I said. You're almost never alone, Todd sighed, then gestured at my more recent photos. It's always the both of you now. Both of us now? I wanted to repeat my question, but it wouldn't come out. He must have read it off my face, because he signed again. Both of you. This time, he pulled one of the older photo albums closer and opened it to a picture of Grandma Elizabeth when she was alive and absent from our lives. Grandma, Todd signed. He pointed at the picture, then pointed at me over my shoulder. This time I looked around. Still, I saw nothing, but felt something different in my newfound awareness, a tightening in my chest as realization crept under my skin. I remember in a flash the scene at Grandma's deathbed, the way she had snatched at my hand the moment her heart had stopped. The keen sense I had of her being trapped somehow, being helpless to release her, though her hand had not released me from the impossible request. When little Todd pointed over my shoulder and signed, Grandma, what I remembered most was not her eyes or the wincing pain of her fingers clawed into my wrist, but the sound in her throat, the strange misplaced anger in it. Had she escaped after all, or was she still trapped here, holding on to me the way she held on to my wrist? Todd stared at me, waiting for my reply. Instead of denial or doubt, I only felt the chill of understanding. I felt sick. I tried not to let it show. I tried to focus on my little brother's gentle, living face to keep me anchored in the moment. Is she still there now? I asked, not helping how my voice dropped as if to keep her from hearing. Despite my best efforts, my voice came out a bit shaky. Is she always there? Often, signed Todd. Not always. She's not here now, but she was. I nodded as though this was expected, but my mind was whirling, trying to catch up. I was thinking of Thimble. How come you don't talk to her? Todd asked next, taking advantage of my disorientation to press the issue about Grandma. I noticed nobody talks to her, or about her. We don't know her too well, and we can't hear her, I said, honestly, but was unsure what else to tell him. What could I say? We can't see her? She isn't even supposed to be here? Why not? He asked, predictably. She can't talk, I said. It's like how you can't talk. Some people can't talk. She can't... I had to stop myself short. I couldn't bring myself to lie to him outright. Not when he knew things we did not. He was looking at me strangely now. Disbelieving. I think she can talk. He signed. I paused. You hear her? I asked. And he nodded without hesitation. Does she talk to you? This time he had to think about it for a moment. He shook his head, then shrugged. His uncertainty unnerved me. She's trying to say something, he signed, finally. At least, I think she is. But it isn't in words. She just makes a sound. I stared at him. What do you mean? What sound? He hesitated. Then his hand hovered somewhere uncertainly over his neck before lightly clasping his own throat. He was having trouble describing what he was hearing, but I understood all too well. That death rattle, that sound deep down in her throat, unexpectedly angry. A strangled sound. Todd lowered his hand when he saw that I understood his meaning. Does she... I paused, found my nerve, and tried again. Does she sound angry? Instead of answering, he glanced over my shoulder, under his eyelashes, then averted his eyes. He nodded. Yes. Yes, she sounds angry. She hadn't escaped after all. And just like all those years ago, standing by her deathbed, she had latched onto me in her failure to escape. And just like all those years ago, I felt helpless to do anything about it. "I'm sorry," I whispered back to him. And I was. I was sorry he had to see that. See what I had seen on that wasted face years before. The unseen look in Grandma's eyes. And to keep seeing it when the rest of us were mercifully blind, mercifully deaf. Todd wouldn't look up at me. I had to ask. "Does she scare you?" A frown crinkled his brow as he thought about it, wanting to give me an honest reply. He had seen her over my shoulder for as long as he had been alive. Could that familiarity have dulled the sharpness in her eyes? Would he have an instinctive wariness of her? "Not really," he replied, finally. "Brave boy," I said, in some relief. "Braver than me, anyway." His lack of fear reassured me in a roundabout way, allowing me to latch onto it and stay calm. With my guard down, I added a bit of confession. "I always thought her eyes were a bit scary."
"They seem like it," Todd replied. "I would be scared too if she looked at me like that."
I didn't like the implications in those words.
How does she look at you?" I asked.
He paused a moment before answering, as if confused by my question.
"She doesn't," he replied. "She never looks at me. She only makes that noise, and she always looks at you."
As if cued by his words, I felt a pinprick awareness of eyes at the back of my head. I dared not look around.
"Maybe if you talked to her, she wouldn't be so angry," Todd sighed.
I leaned both elbows on the table, feeling suddenly heavy and lightheaded at the same time. Again, the helplessness. What on earth could I possibly say this time? To him, to her? "I'm sorry you couldn't get away, but leave me alone." I thought again of Thimble. Todd was signing something else, but I didn't look up at him to read his words until I was ready to take it anymore. He got impatient and tugged at my sleeve, but I was the one who spoke first.
"Do you ever see a cat around here?"
Todd frowned at me as if I were making fun of him.
Never mind, I said.
I decided to not let the dead interfere too much with the living, no matter that some of us had eyes to see and most didn't. Just before Nan came home, I made Todd promise not to talk of Grandma Elizabeth again, and thought he still had many questions about her. He didn't. The staring, however, was a habit I could not shake him out of. A few months later, I watched my little brother die. This would be the third time we would be waiting for death. It had been weeks of waiting before Grandma Elizabeth died, and days of waiting before Thimble did. But it had taken only hours for Todd, the one person of all I wanted to hold here longer. The infection he had narrowly survived had come back, and this time it wouldn't leave without him. His death is the blurriest in memory, though it was more recent, because this time I cared. Love is half blind, and the memory grows cloudier in time the more I obsess over it. I remember his ashen face, the shadows under his eyes, the antiseptic smell of death outside of home, the insulting cheerfulness of the cartoon animals on band-aids hiding the IV needles disappearing into his skin. Our parents were out, getting coffee and making phone calls, waiting for my brothers to fly in, crying on their shoulders. "Hell is a waiting room," I remember thinking. I hadn't cried yet. We were alone in the room. I remember holding Todd's hand, watching his eyes flickering open at the very end. He looked at me, blankly, and then his eyes shifted over my shoulder. My hands tightened instinctively over his.
"I won't let her hurt you,"
I found myself whispering for some reason. It was a promise I didn't know how to keep. His eyes kept flitting between my face and over my shoulder, like Thimble's had. I wanted to get up, scream at the air, and tell her to leave us alone. But before I could, Todd raised his trembling hand, I thought to sign something to me, and waved hello, but not at me. He had always been a polite child. I glanced around over my shoulder, and then back at him, a silent question on my face. He looked at me and signed.
She's looking at me now.
She had never done that before. I held his hands tighter, knowing he might be afraid. He signed.
It's okay.
Then he lowered his hand and closed his eyes, too weak to continue. He died a few minutes later. I was the last one to see him alive. This time, I did not run out with the news. Every day now, I see children dying, slowly or quickly, sometimes expectantly, but always tragically when at work at the children's hospital. At cancer wards and ICUs, I see Todd's face reflecting back at me 100 times over, staring back placidly under the watch of crying strangers. Often, it was only I and the dying child in the room who wouldn't be crying. My family couldn't understand how I could bear to do this sort of work, but I knew I had to. It wasn't because of how we had lost Todd, as they thought, but because I was starting to understand how to get rid of her. I knew her name in life, of course, but in my day-to-day life, I often thought of her as something else. The angel of death, perhaps. And by extension, and under her bidding, I was the angel of the deathbed. That's what some of the grateful parents called me. That was my job. I was called in to calm down frightened children and soothe their mental anguish, and nobody understood how I could. But I always did. The more sickly ones, the ones who had narrowly escaped death at infancy like Thimble and Todd had, often glanced over my shoulder but said nothing. They always seemed to lose the fire to fight, to cry, to be alarmed at their own pain. Their souls grew old in my presence, awaiting death calmly, like one who had lived 5 times as long and 10 times as well. Their parents never understood, and neither did the doctors, but they were glad I was around, and I breathed not a word of her to anyone. Sitting by the children's bedside towards the end of their short lives, I didn't even have to say a word. They only had to look at me, and then at the woman over my shoulder. When her eyes turned from me to them for the first and last time, the light would fade quietly out of their eyes. And, I hoped, the woman would come closer to being free herself, riding on the deaths of others until her own bonds were frayed and she left me. To hurry things along, I would volunteer at the animal shelter after work every so often, helping to put down old dogs and ill cats, making sure their ends were peaceful. The dogs sometimes wagged their tails weakly when they looked over my shoulder, but more often they just stared, wary and resigned. The cats were more likely to act how Thimble did. The irritated flick of the tail, the twitch of the ears as they heard the noise in her throat. How many deaths she would need me to witness on her behalf is anyone's guess. Even outside of work, she drives me to somehow end up on the deathbeds of everyone I know. My parents, Nan, my eldest brother, when all those cigarettes had finally caught up with him. An aunt I was never close with. Somehow, I would always be the last to see them alive, and it was all her doing. I don't think they ever saw her before death. That was a privilege reserved for more innocent eyes, those who had always been closer to death than they were to life. And once they saw her, they couldn't leave without her permission. After Todd had died, I never spoke of Grandma Elizabeth again. There was no need to. She had done her part. She had taught my father that nobody should die alone. I learned that from him, and decided that as far as I could help it, they wouldn't. I still couldn't hear her, of course. Can't sense her there. So for the most part, I can try and continue like she isn't. I'm not always successful. Sometimes I find myself throwing salt over my shoulder and holding my breath. I have no idea whether that does anything. I stare into reflective surfaces at the emptiness over my own shoulder. A compulsive habit at picturing what Todd had seen before he died. Every now and then, when I catch myself imagining I had done all I could, I still find children, always children, glancing over my shoulder outside the hospital. Every now and then, animals would too. That's my only sign that she's still there, fading, wavering, but still trapped. Perhaps mine would be the last death she would need. Perhaps that's why she looked at me more than she looked at anyone else, as Todd had me to believe, calling endlessly without words in her strangled, angry voice. These innocent, knowing, dying eyes are my only sign that I still have a long way to go, endlessly searching, with her eyes at the back of my head, for those about to cross over.